welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. Coming up in this hour, true history. Later on, we'll hear a tale from the Civil War on the Hallmark Playhouse. But right now, stories from World War II and much more on the Passing Parade. This first aired on NBC on July 13, 1943. And if you were a New York radio listener at the time of this broadcast, you would have heard it at 9:30 or tuned into WJZ for Spotlight Bands, A Report to the Nation on WABC, or the Cisco Kit on WOR. And as a producer's note, the first 10 minutes or so of this broadcast is a little rough, though there is some fascinating information. The broadcast will clear up at about the halfway point. It's the Passing Parade.
The Johnson Wax Program, bringing you the voice of Don Nesbitt and the Passing Parade. John Nesbitt, one of the nation's foremost tellers of tales, the news is no matter of cold statistics and technical information, but a thrilling selection of the true stories of the world's rich men, poor men, beggarmen, and thieves. Which here, as in his famed series of MGM pictures, he gathers together as the Passing Parade. Dramatic footnotes to A Summer of Destiny are presented by the makers of Johnson's Wax, Johnson's Self-Polishing Glow Coat, Carnu Auto Polish, and special finishes for many war products. And here is John Nesbitt.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for the night of July 13th, 1943, and another story hunt through the news events of this Summer of Destiny. In bravely predicting last Tuesday night that the world would shake within 14 days with the news of one great Allied blow after another, like commentators everywhere, I was nonetheless caught completely short by the landing on Sicily. Yet as day after day of the amazing communiques have flashed across the ocean to us at home, some have tried to be doubtful, conservative, a little cynical about this news. But with the fall of Syracuse, one mighty step on the road to the Straits of Messina, followed today by Augusta, it became humanly impossible to avoid a cry of joy. For it has so far been overlooked by the commentators that in making our landing, not at the expected places on the south of the island, which would have been easiest, but sweeping around to the east coast far up toward the north, our leaders did perform a piece of strategy which will go down in history. By this move, they took advantage of the very thing we feared most, the prodigious mountains of Sicily. And they turned it into a trump card, for they placed the mountains between our fighting men and the bulk of the defending enemy. If the man responsible for that magnificent piece of daring and dangerous strategy is Eisenhower, it becomes apparent that when a supreme commander is finally selected in Europe, that commander is more than ever likely to be an American, and his name will be Eisenhower. One picture lying over the map of that two-mile-wide strait that is our goal, Messina. A picture of the stretch of water which is one of the most dreaded places in the world. It is the scorpion of the Mediterranean Sea. And that is why the ancient Greeks believed that on one rock in the strait there lived a terrible monster who yelped like a dog, who had 12 clawing feet and 6 necks of enormous length. Each neck fitted out with a head with 3 rows of fangs in it. With these heads, it clutched ships and sent them beneath the waves. Today, that same channel of water is again a place of horror for the actors. Where once the many-headed monster lived, now come the many-headed fighter planes of the Allies, reaching out to destroy all craft which attempt to negotiate these waters to reinforce the Axis troops. Then there are the people of Sicily, 3.5 million of them or more, a dark, hard, lawless people, passionate in love and hate. They're treacherous, they're mercenary, and they're courageous. Their home conquered again and again, these dark people are in themselves unconquerable. There in the shadow of the volcano Etna, where our men will soon be moving into the final battle, hide the secret societies of the Mafia. From this society of murderers came the Black Hand that terrorized America. And from the Black Hand came the gangster bands of Al Capone and Lucky Luciano. Every one of Al Capone's 13 bodyguards was a Sicilian, and a vast majority of the Italian descended, whose machine guns roared through our cities in the days of the bootleg wars, came first from this beautiful, treacherous island for which the fight goes on tonight. Final Sicilian picture from a storyteller's notebook must go back to a day 300 years before Christ walked in Nazareth. Then, as now, the port of Syracuse was the locked gate that any invader must burst open before he could be master of Sicily. At that time, there lived in Syracuse a man who was the Einstein of his day, a genius of mathematics named Archimedes. When the invader came, Archimedes invented one of the world's first death rays, through which he was able to throw a hot beam out to invading ships and set them afire. So Syracuse took exactly 3 years to conquer. 23 centuries later, on Monday, July 12th, the city fell to Montgomery in 3 hours. To move on with the parade to another part of the world. Not long ago, a song swept through the German army. It was called the Song of the Young Century, and its melody we're hearing now for perhaps the first time here in America. We have suspected for some time that there was a story hidden behind this melancholy air, and here it is at last. Do you remember from the last war the Hymn of Hate? It is one of the things that undoubtedly cost Germany the last world war. Yet the Prussians, still running things there, have actually repeated that error all over again. The Hymn of Hate was Ernst Liebauer's song that went, "We will never forgo our hate. We have all but a single hate. We love as one, we hate as one. We have one foe and one alone, England." By 1918, the common German soldiers, who'd been made to sing that so many times, had begun to hate not us, but the song itself. At last, they hated the Prussian officers who fought it up. And not long ago, Ernst Liebauer, who wrote the Hymn of Hate, ended up as a half-mad, broken-hearted man. He wandered around Nazi Germany looking for a friend, finding everywhere only disgust and enmity. It killed its maker, too, the once famous Hymn of Hate. Yet never good at learning the lessons of the human heart, the present military rulers of the Germans set to work with a whole gang of songwriters and tried to turn out a batch of fresh Hymns of Hate for this war. As you recall, the Nazis thought up first the one called Sailing Against England, and their military band puffed away at it with might and main. Farewell, for we sail against England. Our flag see it wave from the mast. Of Germany's strength it speaks. We are going to halt at last. The Englishman's sneering laugh. Today it is verboten in many regiments, because so many disgruntled German privates have begun singing not the approved words, but still sailing against England, only backwards. They had the same trouble over there with a hit song in Berlin last year, which was made at the time that Marshal Rommel was smashing the Allies back across the desert. It was called Rumbling Along in Africa. But just as everybody in Berlin began singing it, Rommel stopped rumbling along, got pushed right back at his heels, and began to run like the devil toward Tunis. And there died a German hit song. Still, the Prussians can't get it into their heads that singing is a thing you do with your heart. And no song of hate has ever lasted. But all the time that the German armies have been dying in Russia, stalled everywhere inside their iron walls, many a simple soldier, just as he did in 1918, is beginning to remember the beautiful heart song with which he grew up, the tender one his mother sang to him when he was a child. Then as he grew older, the exquisite love songs he heard from his first girl. But these are too unwarlike.
Don't sing that decadent nonsense. Sing like men. Sing hate. Sing marches. Sing of the honor of death. Sing of cuts and Russian throats. string of snakes in history for the next 1,000 years.
And so it has gone. Yet today, modern Nazi regiment after regiment has begun to sing another song. This new one, now the overwhelming favorite of the plain German soldiers, has nothing to do with victory. It actually has to do with defeat, with sadness, with longing for peace. And the words of it go, in front of the barracks, before the heavy gate, there stood a lamppost. And if it's standing yet, then we shall meet there once again, beside the lamppost in the rain. The lamppost knows your footsteps, so lovely and so free. For you it burns unceasing, but it has forgotten me. And if I do not return again, who will stand beside you in the rain? This does not sound like a song of hate and vengeance, does it? This sounds like the song of men who are growing tired. Maybe it means nothing. And maybe it is a straw blown on the bitter wind of coming events. But certainly it is the old truth that the Prussians never understand. That you do not set hate to music, but only the best in the human heart.
It is gray dawn. The trenches of the Carso sector, called Battle Section Number 144 of the Italian Army, high in the Alps. And the date is February 22nd, 1917. In the trench are 20 human beings who have found themselves in the dead center of hell, of active battle. 18 mud-covered, panting privates, and one lieutenant and one corporal. All of these men are lobbing hand grenades over the trenches just as fast as they can, for a furious assault is being made on their position. They tear the pins out with their teeth, hurl the metal bombs madly off into space. And three positions from where the corporal stands, a man jerks his grenade up to his mouth, wrenches out the firing pin, raises it to throw, at which second a sniper's bullet finds him, hits him straight between the eyes, and the man drops to the bottom of the trench, the sputtering hand grenade clutched tightly in his dead fingers. 3 seconds and the grenade blows up. A series of explosions as the concussion sets off a whole case of grenades. The air fills with hot metal, and at last the whole trench collapses as if a giant earthquake had struck. Later on, the rescue squad digs out that area. There were 20 men, 18 privates, the lieutenant, the corporal. There are now 19 corpses and one dying man. Him they cart back to the hospital, and the surgeons hopelessly work on him. 27 different operations, and yet the man lives. Lives to send his name crashing over the earth. Corporal Benito Mussolini. What if he had died? But he didn't die, did he? He lived to destroy his nation, stab France, and in this month of 1943, lie awake in agony as the avenging allies landed on the beaches of his homeland. And the curtain rises now on another. We are in Madras, India, exactly 2 centuries ago this month. Hordes of dark-faced people in flashing costume filling the narrow streets. The native holiday. Tremendous gaiety in spite of heat no white man can survive. And inside an oven-like little office in the headquarters of the British East India Company, a young English clerk, racked with malaria, his brain twisted into melancholia and despair, picks up a loaded pistol. He very carefully sees that it is properly primed and cocked. And then he raises it to his temple. For the bookkeeper, office clerk of the East India Company, sees no future for himself except ledgers, which he loathes. He's homesick for England,
and he is certain that his life is useless and wasted. He sucks in his breath and pulls the trigger. Nothing happens. No explosion. Now perspiration bursts out from his face. His hand begins to shake. But he clenches his teeth, examines the priming carefully again, raises the pistol, and again pulls the trigger. For the second time, a click of the hammer and no explosion. The bookkeeper faintly drops into a chair. A friend comes in, and the clerk suddenly speaks to him.
Take this gun, point it out that window. Shoot.
Either you've too much malaria or too much heat, but here goes.
Here, let me see that. Just twice I have tried to kill myself with this thing. It would not fire. Maybe destiny has reserved my health, life, or something else.
10 years pass. 3,000 British soldiers meet a foe of 50,000 tribesmen. One of the great battles of mankind. The English win, and India becomes a jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And the man who forged that victory was the pale young bookkeeper who closed his ledgers when his suicide failed to become a soldier. His name was Robert Clive. Clive of India. On and on go the pages of history, always sounding this extraordinary fact, that nearly every man who has changed the story of mankind has at one time or another been curiously preserved by destiny. Now it is the winter of 1915, a frontline trench, the Merville sector of France. It is very quiet. The shelling has stopped. A plump little colonel of the Fusiliers is using the lull to write a few letters home. An orderly steps into the colonel's dugout, salutes, and hands him a field telegram. The corps commander wishes to see the colonel at 4 o'clock. A car will be waiting at the Rue Croix crossroads at 3:15. Cursing splendidly at that commander, the plump colonel gets up and he obeys his orders. Through a mile and a half of deep mud, he wades to get to the Rue Croix road. He arrives and he splatters the air with mud and cuss words at exactly 3:10. There is no car waiting. A half hour passes. No car arrives. Then an hour. The little colonel stands there, the rain pouring down his neck. And at 4:40, a sergeant slogs up the road to that shivering officer. Colonel, the general sends respects. There's been a mistake. Your car was sent to the wrong place, and now it's too late to see the general. He says you'd mind to rejoin your unit. An hour later, the furious, still cursing colonel splashes back into his company trench, and his servant, called a batman, hurries up to him.
Oh, I've moved your kit to Captain Oliver's dugout, sir. He says he'd be glad to share it.
But why the devil have you moved my stuff out of my own dugout?
Oh, I thought you knew, sir. Just for an hour and a half after you left to see the general, a whiz-bang landed square on your dugout. All that is left is a hole in the ground.
A hole in the ground. The colonel looked at him for a moment and began to roar with wild laughter. And the next afternoon, that corps commander, who had called the colonel out for an appointment that wasn't kept, received a huge case of the finest champagne, on top of which was a neat card from the colonel. Dear General, love and kisses. Signed, Colonel Winston L.S. Churchill. If that accidental invitation had not arrived, if the car had not been misrouted so that he had returned to his dugout a little earlier, then Winston Churchill would never have been alive to guide England during her crucial hour. And during the First World War, an ambulance in France had picked up the body of a young English officer. Finding no life remaining, it had started off toward a cemetery. Arriving there, the two drivers got out and went around to remove the body.
All right. I'll get inside to take hold of the...
Dear God, what body is it?
I thought I saw it move.
No.
Nevertheless, I don't think I'll ever sleep sound again unless we take it back to the doctors.
60 minutes later, a physician looks up from an operating table. Yes, he is alive. The hopeless was attempted, an operation followed, and that soldier lived. He lived to hurl the Nazi out of Libya, drive the enemy onto the bayonets of the Americans, and so make possible the invasion of Sicily this week. We know him today as General Sir Bernard L. Montgomery, CB, DSO. And now add to the list a black-haired athlete who dozens of times was sent out on missions that were suicide jobs, who had bombs burst virtually in his hands, who escaped from houses that were shot through with machine gun bullets, who eight times had a price, placed on his head, who was driven through a 100-foot double-long line of men once, who each struck at him with a heavy bar as he passed, who survived every single one of these adventures with such luck that his people named him Man of Steel, and whom the Germans know today as Stalin, leader of the soldiers who stood before Leningrad until the world's greatest try for conquest had become a ruin. And finally, and lest I overlook one of the most extraordinary of these mysterious quirks of destiny that changed the history of the parade, let me come to the strangest of them all. The date now is November 9th, 1923, and we are standing huddled against the side of a building, watching a riot on the broad central square of the city of Munich, the Marienplatz. In the chaos of Central Europe after the war, the Bavarian government faltered and was about to fall. The National Socialist Party of Bavaria decided to seize the reins of power. And now, across the square, they march. In front is an old, stiff-backed man, General Ludendorff. Two standard-bearers are carrying the flag, then new to the world, of the Buck Cross, the swastika. Rank upon rank of shock troops, brown-shirted, proudly stepping forward. It is 11:08 in the morning. The column swings right from the Marienplatz to enter the Palace of Government. But there, placed across the steps, is a gray line of grim, steel-helmeted police, crouched down behind machine guns. One of the Nazis opens his mouth to speak. Party leader Adolf Hitler. He throws up an arm, but his screaming words are drowned in a burst of gunfire. And down he goes under a thick hail of bullets. And more of them, and whole rows of brown shirts, until the pavement runs scarlet with blood. One man only holds his march. Straight old Ludendorff. He marches on, alone, until he stands squarely in front of the muzzle of a machine gun. And, of course, the firing stops. The riot has ended. And now the brown shirts count their dead. Adolf Hitler was among the first to fall right in the center of a river of steel bullets. A man named Goering is picked up, badly wounded, but alive, and corpses are carried across the red cobblestone. Then at last they lift the body of the standard bearer, dead, with the great banner of the swastika floating down over him. And they stop, for beneath the body of the standard bearer is party leader Adolf Hitler, alive. Save for a wrist wrenched in the fall, he is untouched. At the second of fire, the standard bearer had stumbled one pace to the left, and he had received the river of death that was aimed at Adolf Hitler. So he lived, leaving all the world to wonder forever afterward what might have happened if that standard bearer had not stumbled. Why did death spare them, the men of darkness and the men of good, who were locked together in the struggle today? There is no answer. Yet this I know, that if destiny sometimes spares men of enormous evil, it is also always careful to preserve the lives of the men who one day rise up to destroy them. And perhaps there is a young boy fighting in Sicily, utterly unknown to us tonight or to the world, who has been miraculously saved from certain death today somewhere, who will come to learn that destiny saved him because it had something else in store. And such a boy may tower up tomorrow to become one of the hopes of our future, a giant in the passing parade. When we join you again next Tuesday evening, it will be, unless, of course, the news of the hour becomes irresistible again, to bring a group of true stories which will be far removed from the war and the people of today. And now, with a bow to Carmen Dragon for his specially composed dramatic music, this is John Nesbitt bidding a very good evening to you all. This is Carlton Cadell speaking for the makers of Johnston Wax Finishes for Home and Industry, inviting you to be with us again next Tuesday night when we again present John Nesbitt in The Passing Parade. This program has reached you from Hollywood. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The Passing Parade, on Tuned to Yesterday from July 13th, 1943 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier. And now from World War II to the Civil War and the story of how a woman helped Abe Lincoln during that time, this December 9th, 1948 broadcast of the Hallmark Playhouse is called Woman with a Sword and stars Ida Lupino and Gerald Moore.
The Hallmark Playhouse. Each week, Hallmark will bring you Hollywood's greatest stars in outstanding stories chosen by one of the world's best-known authors, the distinguished novelist, Mr. James Hilton. Now, Hallmark Playhouse, starring Ida Lupino in Hollister Noble's Woman with a Sword.
The year 1865, the day victory. Abraham Lincoln sent the following message to Secretary of War Stanton.
Mr. Secretary, I concur most heartily with your recent statement. As you said so eloquently, hers was the greatest course in the war. As an unofficial member of the cabinet, she did the great work that made others famous. Miss Anna Ella Carroll.
Unusual, isn't it? Anna Ella Carroll, a name you probably never heard of. I never did until recently. And yet, in Secretary of War Stanton's own words, she did the great work that made others famous. Anna Ella Carroll, woman with a sword.
Mr. Lincoln, if this cabinet meeting proves anything at all after 1 year of war, it proves that we have armies without a plan, a nation without a head.
Well, poor as it is, I am the head of this nation by the body's free choice. A civilian, as confused as yourself and with no legal right whatsoever to dictate to the armed forces. That's the province of our commander-in-chief, General McClellan. The army's plan is to open the Mississippi, which none of us have the power to alter. But I may have some more news for you on that subject tomorrow. Well, good day, gentlemen.
Good day, Mr. President.
Mr. President, Judge Bates to see you.
Oh, hello, Judge Bates.
Well, Mr. President, did you read it?
I have studied it, sir. It proves beyond any doubt the constitutional fact that in time of war, the president becomes commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Thank heaven.
Surely the need for secrecy as to this lawyer's identity no longer exists. Who is it?
A lawyer whose specialty is transportation, rail, and river.
Perfect. He can take a crack at the Mississippi expedition. Where is he?
This lawyer is in the other room awaiting an audience. Mr. President, may I present the author of the document which proves you commander-in-chief, Miss Anna Ella Carroll of Maryland.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. I'm sorry to see you looking so tired.
I'm not tired, ma'am. Just flabbergasted. Please do sit down, Miss Carroll.
Now you see the need for secrecy.
But it's unfair.
I'm accustomed to it, Mr. President. This is a man's world. Besides, I'm a Southerner.
Oh, of course. Anna Ella Carroll. You were the young lady who was charged with being a traitor to the Union, operating right under our noses here in Washington.
Yes, I believe the gentleman who proved my treachery was Colonel Lem Evans of Texas.
Until I explained that you were the source of all my confidential data, Colonel Evans was only doing his duty.
And I should like to do mine. A woman can accomplish many things which men can't.
Including things men should have done. Your heart is with the South. Your mind tells you that preserving the Union is the only way to preserve the South.
What are you driving at, Mr. President?
Our military is staking everything on the Mississippi expedition. We must open that great river. Well, you're an expert on transportation. Go to St. Louis, the headquarters of our Mississippi expedition. Then tell me whether you believe it can work.
The city is under martial law. I'll need an escort.
Fair enough. I've just the man for you. An ardent believer in the Mississippi plan, Colonel M. Evans.
You mean the gentleman who charged me with treason?
These are my orders. You've no one to blame but yourself. It was you who just made me commander-in-chief.
Sir, here are Miss Carroll's bags. We'll be docking in St. Louis in a few moments.
Oh, thank you.
That's a strong current.
The Mississippi, ma'am.
And heading south like the tide of this war.
We're changing that with our expedition. Those gunboats built by James Eads are strong and big.
Too big.
They're for combat, not pleasure.
I was thinking of combat, Colonel. They're clumsy. Death traps. The slightest damage can put them out of commission, and our boys will float southward on the current to certain death.
If you have some practical suggestion which would alter the Mississippi and make it run backwards, I'm sure we'd all be indebted to you.
Why not alter the plans of men, Colonel? I've interviewed everyone out here, and I'm convinced that no intelligent person can support the Mississippi expedition.
Surely you're not suggesting the Mississippi expedition is stupid and unworkable.
You express my feelings very well, sir.
The armies that will win this war must be transported by river. That's why the enemy waits on one end of the Mississippi and we at the other.
But the southward current is on their side.
Which we will fight with our gunboats.
A contest you cannot win.
The chances of war, ma'am.
Not war, Colonel. Suicide.
Now the boat's in. I have completed my function as your guide. I'll say goodnight, Miss Carroll.
I trust, Colonel. There's still enough southern chivalry left in you to help me with my bags to the dock.
By all means, ma'am.
What's that?
Boatload of wounded soldiers, miss.
All right there. Pile the wounded under the shed. Make way down below for the ambulances. Careful of the medicine. It's all that's left.
Let me through, pilot.
Are you a nurse, ma'am?
I'm here on official business from Washington. These are my credentials.
Credentials? More papers. If you're not a nurse, there's no room for you here, ma'am. Not a pleasant sight for a woman's eyes, either. Wounded and maimed they are. 200 left out of 2,000.
What happened, pilot? I'm Colonel Evans.
They knocked out the engines of our 5 gunboats and we drifted downstream. Living targets. By the time the engine of our 1 boat was repaired to pull back north, 1,800 had been slaughtered.
Please, let us through.
Sergeant, let this lady and gentleman through.
Right, Captain. Wait, Martha. It's too soon.
Must be the lad's wife. Sweetheart, he keeps talking to her.
I don't want to die. We can't all be cowards. I heard the others. I saw them. Don't you see, Martha? It wasn't like fighting and losing. The river was against us. It was losing without a chance to fight.
You're not cowards. You're heroes. And you'll all have a fair chance to fight. I promise you. I swear it.
That's how they die, all of them. Speaking of the chance to fight they didn't have.
Pilot, get us some smelling salts and water.
Sergeant, smelling salts in the canteen. Quick about it.
Aye, sir.
Cowards. Yes, cowards. Afraid to admit you're wrong. Sending men to their deaths without a chance for victory.
Easy, Miss Carroll. You'll be in bed soon.
And what a fair bed. 6 feet of earth or the cold bottom of the river. The river. The river. That's it. It does flow north.
She's hysterical.
The Tennessee River. And it would split the rebel armies in half.
Captain, we'd better get her to the pilot's house. She's delirious.
She may be delirious, Colonel, but she's talking facts for sure. The Tennessee River does flow north, and taking it would split the rebel forces.
The Mississippi flows south, with enemies at either end. A plan for war ending in disaster. But the Tennessee flows north, with friends at either end. A plan for victory ending in peace. I don't need smelling salts. What I want is the pilot's logbook, river maps, pencil and paper. How long have you been on these rivers, pilot?
Just a week shy of 40 years, Miss Carroll.
Then you know them well.
As well as you know the human heart, young lady.
Good. We have work to do. There's a study in my hotel suite. And you are free to join us, Colonel Evans. That is, if you care to.
Clock, Miss Carroll, and I admit defeat. My brain won't work. My eyes are shutting.
Now, you're quite sure, Pilot Scott, that the Tennessee River is not too shallow at any point to carry those heavy gunboats?
Not to my knowledge.
And from General Grant, you know for a fact that beyond Forts Henry and Donelson, there are no Southern soldiers stationed along the Tennessee.
They're all inland or on the Mississippi.
Oh, then the shores of the Tennessee are not flanked by rebel soldiers. Only Southerners, Americans, loyal to the Union.
We hope.
Hope means uncertainty, Pilot. And I have none. I am as certain of the depth of their loyalty as you are of the Tennessee. Now, if some of our gunboats were disabled on the Tennessee River, they'd float north, back into Union hands.
Any fool who's piloted the boat in the Tennessee would confirm that.
And why, in heaven's name, has no one thought of asking you river pilots?
You seem to have forgotten. We are all Southerners.
And you have forgotten, Pilot. We now have a commander-in-chief who doesn't think in terms of North and South, but only in terms of Americans loyal to the Union.
Miss Carroll, of all the idiots in this army, I must be the biggest. I should have realized that you sought the answers to questions that we lack courage to face. Miss Carroll,
Carroll, little lady's fallen asleep.
I'll carry her to the couch. How small she is. How could those little pink ears hear so much? And those soft eyes see so clearly. Can it be that this little girl I hold in my arms will prove to be the military strategist who will save our Union?
Her authorship was kept a secret. Others thought it was Grant's. President Lincoln fought for it. Stanton agreed to become Secretary of War on condition that the Union abandon the Mississippi expedition and carry through Ann's Tennessee plan. But on every other side, the plan met with nothing but resistance. So here we are. Anna Ella Carroll is waiting in a room adjoining the presidential chamber. Unaware that she's listening in the next room, are assembled the leaders of the military, transportation experts, the men in charge of guiding the war.
Mr. President, I was born in Tennessee. The Tennessee River is not deep enough to carry the gunboats into Southern territory.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. We'll weigh your remarks with due respect.
Mr. President, I take it you're determined not to disclose the name of the author of this so-called Tennessee plan.
Correct, sir, for reasons of security.
Security? With no disrespect, Mr. President, your so-called Tennessee plan is so disastrous, I'm forced to the conclusion that its author is either a civilian, an amateur, or a rebel.
You are forced, General, into rudeness by the painful necessity of facing the bare possibility that we were in error, while the author of this plan is correct.
Good day, gentlemen. We reconvene tomorrow morning. You heard, Miss Carroll?
Civilian, amateur, rebel. Need only add the word woman. Mr. President, give them proof. Once Fort Henry and Donelson fall, all it would take is one Union gunboat on the Tennessee River with a crew of 15. It could go all the way into Mississippi and Alabama without a shot being fired. And I can prove it.
Can you? Where would you find men brave enough to volunteer for such a mission?
Pilot Scott and 13 of his riverboat crew.
That still leaves one.
Sir, you seem to have forgotten me.
Mr. President, Forts Henry and Donelson have been captured.
Good. Now pray God that young lady can prove her case.
Pilot, you're sure the crew doesn't know I'm on board?
Quite sure, Miss Carroll.
Have we passed the worst of it?
No, ma'am. Up ahead is the low water mark.
Oh, it has to be deep enough. It has to. The Union depends on it.
And?
Len. Len, what are you doing here?
How could you have planned to do this without me?
Well, I thought you might still disagree with this plan.
That was only one of many mistakes I've made, and since corrected.
Oh, Len, I'm glad you're here.
And there's one mistake I can't afford to make. And that would be not to tell you how much I've come to love you in so short a time.
And I must tell you that I feel the same about you, Len. In fact, at this moment, it's the only thing I'm really sure of.
Oh, this is a good time to be sure of such a thing.
Here it comes, Miss Carroll. Low water mark. We're inches from bottom. Close your eyes and pray.
Cleared it. And at low water.
All that remains to be tested now, Miss Carroll, is the depth of Southern loyalty. That's my first mate.
We're in enemy waters, Captain. The sun's up. Shall we man the guns?
No. Break out the flag and stand by to hoist.
Captain, they've seen us, and they're rushing out of their houses to the shore with guns.
You heard the orders.
Head closer to shore, pilot.
Aye, ma'am.
Not a promising welcome.
Waiting orders, ma'am.
Hoist the Union flag with full naval ceremony.
I'd better wait until we find out their reaction.
That's the only way to find out their reaction.
Hoist the Union flag with full ceremony.
Union armies win smashing victory at Vicksburg. Union army occupies Chattanooga. Atlanta captured. Richmond surrenders.
As though somewhere it isn't really over.
Oh, but it is over, darling. Now we can go to Texas as Mr. and Mrs. Evans.
What a wonderful fruit of victory.
The only fruit of victory that will satisfy me is an end to this conspiracy of silence about you. Your plan won the war, and the world has been clamoring for its author. When you speak to Mr. Lincoln alone today, you better raise this question or I will.
Spoken like a man of the family. Oh, here he comes. Here comes the president. Good morning, Mr. President.
Wonderful morning. Won't you join me, Miss Carroll?
Thank you.
Well, Miss Carroll, you made a commander-in-chief. You gave him a plan. You helped him carry it out. You won a war.
Sir, my thoughts are on peace.
The Secretary of War, Stanton, spoke to me last night. He advised me that he would consider it a great privilege to present you to Congress and Senate as the author of the Tennessee Plan, demanding legislation that would grant you the honorary pay of a major general of the Union armies, dating from 1861.
Mr. President.
However, exercising my prerogative as president, I turn him down.
I understand.
The privilege of presenting you to Congress and Senate is something I insist upon doing myself.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Before us lies the mangled road to peace, Miss Carroll. You come from Maryland. A lot of important work could be done there.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm marrying Len Evans and returning to Texas with him.
Well, war is over. I'm no longer commander-in-chief. You should go to Texas. And perhaps I should reread that verse which comes from the Bible. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time of war and a time of peace.
Yes, Mr. President. And peace is the season for love.
Oh,
Lem, are you sure I look right in this dress?
Well, you don't look like a major general, darling. But you do look like my bride-to-be.
Oh, that must be my bonnet. Come in. Judge Bates, what is it?
President Lincoln was shot an hour ago.
Shot?
Is he badly hurt?
He's dying.
Oh, no. I don't believe it.
Now that you're more composed, Anne, I must speak of something. The President has planned to present to you for recognition today, as you know. Secretary of War Stanton can do it instead. The decision is entirely up to you. But you realize, Anne, that such an announcement at this time would jeopardize the peace.
Will there ever be a proper time
wait,
to...
Wait, wait, Len. The President was right, and we were wrong. We called it peace, and in its deceptive glow, a killer aimed... Now Lincoln is dead. We have not won the peace, Lem. We must still fight for it. Judge Bates, please inform the Secretary of War that I would consider it most inappropriate to present me to the Congress and Senate at this time of national disaster.
And you're making it easier for all of us. We will be grateful. Good night.
And what were you trying to tell me?
Lem, darling, I too should like to rest. I would like to be alone. I have a lot of thinking to do. To the Honorable... The Very Honorable Lem Evans, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of Texas. My darling, darling Lem. Yes, in the last 3 years, my answers to your letters have been infrequent and far too brief. My heart has been too full to permit it more expression. Now my head is in command, and I can tell you with all my heart that I love you and always shall, and hope one day to share a happy life with you in Texas. But the peace is not yet won, and in time of war, each defends his home. Yours is Texas. Mine is Maryland. Perhaps you are right that there is no real end to the fight for peace, and therefore to the road I'm traveling. But I desperately hope you are wrong. But even if you aren't, I cannot leave the battlefield now. The fact that I have not received recognition does not matter. Someday, somehow, that recognition will come. I have no hunger for it, Lem. My hunger is only for you. Sometimes I feel that I must rush blindly to Texas at once, forgetting everything. Then I remember. I remember the last words that President Lincoln spoke to me. And I know now why he spoke them. And I hope that you too may understand. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under the heaven. A time of war and a time of peace. Yours forever and ever. Anna Ella Carroll.
We'll hear from James Hilton and Ida Lupino again. But I do want to remind you that by selecting your Hallmark Christmas cards now, you'll find cards so suitable they seem specially written for every person on your list. Here again is James Hilton.
Miss Lupino, you've just brought to life for us a great American woman. Your performance was a tribute to her memory. For the makers of Hallmark cards, our gratitude for your charming presence here this evening and our thanks for your unforgettable performance of A Forgotten Woman.
Thank you, Mr. Hilton. It was a great privilege to play Anna Ella Carroll. I hope that we have done something here this evening that will help to bring her the honor she deserves. It's a human frailty, I suppose, to forget. But then you Hallmark people are doing such a splendid job to overcome that, to help people remember with those fine Hallmark greeting cards of yours. Oh, thank you again for asking me to be here. I have enjoyed it.
Do please visit us anytime. Our Hallmark Playhouse is every Thursday. Our music is by Lynn Murray. Our director-producer is D. Engelbach. And our adaptation tonight was by J. Richard Kennedy. And next week, we shall present a most unusual Christmas story, The Desert Shall Rejoice, starring John Hodiak. And the following week, two nights before Christmas, we'll tell you a great story with great music, the true story of how Silent Night came to be sung throughout the world. I believe these are two shows you won't want to miss. Until next Thursday, then, this is James Hilton saying good night.
Look for Hallmark cards that are sold only in stores that have been carefully selected to give you expert and friendly service. Remember Hallmark cards when you care enough to send the very best. Ida Lupino is currently being starred in Roadhouse, a 20th Century Fox production. This is Frank Goss saying goodnight to you all until next week at the same time when James Hilton returns to present The Desert Shall Rejoice, starring John Hodiak. This program came to you from the Hallmark Playhouse. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Hallmark Playhouse on Tuned 2 yesterday from December 9th, 1948 on CBS. That closes this hour of True History on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. It's been a pleasure.